Be happy.
Hi, this is Gail Moskowitz, and you're listening to Mental Health Matters. It's Thursday at 1. That is the time we air Mental Health Matters. The show moved to 1 o'clock on Thursday a couple of weeks ago, so I hope that you guys have found us on the radio. As you know, on Mental Health Matters, we choose a topic, we speak about it, something that has to do with mental health, that has to do with how people function together, that have to do with friendships, relationships, marriages, parenting. Also want to begin, and we will begin to start talking about the politics of mental health, the social policy of mental health. Well, we're going to highlight one of these issues, as we do every week, and you, the audience, is welcome to call and ask me a question about the topic that we're speaking about, or to weigh in on the subject. The number today to call us is, to call me, is 649-9737, 649-9737, and I'd love to hear from you today. Our topic today on Mental Health Matters is suicide. Not such a fun topic to talk about, but one that I think is so oddly experienced by people who hear about somebody committing suicide. And I'm going to talk about the nuances of that in a moment. For now, I want to just say out loud, again, this is Mental Health Matters. My name is Gail Moskowitz. I'm your host. You can call me today at 649-9737. If you would like to hear the show later today or anytime, you can do so by logging on to WRIR's website, www.rir.org. If you log on to that website and you click my show, you'll see my website, and then you'll have directions to go to where all of the shows are archived. So today we're going to talk about suicide. This is why I chose this topic. Something awful happened this week. While there are a lot of wonderful things happened this week, something happened that was just extremely disconcerting. And that's that a client of mine, who I have not seen in many, many years, and no longer lives in Richmond, called me. And she told me that she was so distressed because her father, who was in his 80s, had taken his own life. And she did not have any idea how that could have happened. This man who she had grown up with, who had played soccer with her, who was really a very lovely man, taught her, patient. He always had a sad side to him. And really, one of the things she and I had dealt with when she was in treatment with me were the issues that were part and parcel of her father being a little sad. And that's how she would describe him. So in thinking about it, the fact that this man eventually took his life wasn't shocking, but that he did take his life and how she was experiencing it at that moment was very shocking. So I then remembered back to something that happened about 5 years ago. And what happened was that I had another person that I knew, and that person had made a very serious attempt to take their life. And what that person was so unbelievably struck by was how angry all the people around, all the people with whom that person was attached, were so angry at her. Angry, angry, angry. And I knew that this happens. If you have conversations with people about suicide, they'll say to you, I can't understand that. I think that's really selfish. I think that nobody has the right to do that. You don't have the right to kill anyone else. You don't have the right to kill yourself. And it's interesting to me that many people I know who are quite empathetic to other people's pain and quite empathetic to the things that derail us are not very empathetic to the idea of killing oneself. Isn't that an interesting thought? The other thing I want to say in this, and then I'm going to throw some statistics out to you because I think they're interesting and important to hear. So the other thing I want to say is, many years ago, I was very involved in the AIDS community. I'm not so involved in the AIDS community anymore, just that I work in other arenas right now. But at some point, probably a third of my caseload was HIV infected. And I met some pretty amazing human beings during this time. Funny and warm and young and beautiful and full of energy and very sick. Sick because in those days, there was not much hope for longevity living with HIV. Things have certainly shifted in today's world, although it's still not an easy disease to live with. It wasn't a sudden death sentence, and in those days it was. So I had these young people in my office, mostly men, but not all, who were very, very scared and really losing their life in the prime of their lives. And my job was to help them to connect to what they had left of their lives. And some of them could do it. Some of them really did amazing things. And through the Catholic diocese, they run something called Transformation Retreats. It's the most amazing program for people who are living with HIV. Through those retreats, through deciding this was their short life and they were going to make the most of it, many of my clients got well emotionally, and some didn't. And at the later stages of their disease progressed, I had two people who took their lives. One by taking all the medication that he was given, and another by driving into a stationary object with his car and taking his own life, and somebody else who tried to take his own life but didn't and then died really within the year from other complications from HIV. So it was interesting to me that my response to those young men was that, and I actually have heard that somebody else I worked with for many, many years, a long time ago, who's been living with HIV for probably 18 years, has actually in the past year, and they don't live here anymore, had taken their life. So my response to that was almost a feeling of this was the only control left to them. They hated living with this disease. They were terribly sick. They couldn't work. There was no modicum of themselves left, and they just had to do it. And on some level, I understood. I was sad. I was horrified. I was scared. I was sick to my stomach. I buried a lot of friends in those years. And to bury these clients was very painful to me. But on some level, I gave them their power, their due. They made that decision. Regardless of the work we were doing together or the relationships I knew that they knew how to create. So in reflecting on what happened this week, I want to just throw some statistics out to you. And we'll talk a little bit about why people kill themselves and how we then, as a society, wind up feeling in the face of that. So, and again, this is Gail Moskowitz. I'm talking to you today. This is Mental Health Matters. And if you'd like to talk to me about this subject, 649-9737, please give me a ring, 649-9737. Okay, so let me just go through this. Why do people kill themselves? Why would they kill themselves? Well, I just said one reason, because they're chronically ill and they don't want to live with the chronicity of their illness, and they want to die when they have some control over their own destiny. So the biggest reason people kill themselves is that they live day to day with debilitating depression or intermittent debilitating depression, or other mental disorders. That mental disorder is complicated by the use of substances, so they're not thinking straight. And you really see this combination in people who might kill themselves is the depression and then the introduction of using substances. More than 90% of people who do die by suicide have these risk factors. So another thing that is a risk factor is that if somebody has actually tried to kill themselves before, they'd be more likely to attempt again and to actually succeed. A family history of mental disorders or substance abuse, a family history of suicide. The statistics for a young person who either parent has killed themselves, the statistics are really astronomical. I can't give you the exact numbers, but they really go up. And I guess on some level it's because that person now thinks that that is a viable option for managing their emotional pain. Family violence, including physical and sexual abuse. And again, I look at that as somebody who feels powerless in their family situation because they're young, because they're so tethered to the insanity of that situation, that they really are tired of living with that kind of dysfunction and choose suicide. Sexual abuse, another risk factor. And here's one that people who are proponents of guns might not want to hear, but it's a statistic. I'm just giving it to you. Firearms in the home. If there is a gun in the home, then you have an option to use it. And that makes the statistics for suicide a little bit higher. Actually, I don't know how much higher. I'd have to get those numbers for you. But it's important to know that guns are used in more than half of suicides. You don't have a gun in your house. You have to do the work to go get the gun before you can use it against yourself. And one of the things that's on your side if you are contemplating suicide is stopping and thinking. So not having a gun in your house makes you less likely to use it against yourself or anybody else. Incarceration. Again, I talk about the powerlessness. Being incarcerated is an absolutely intolerable way of living. And some people do not have the emotional stability to manage it, and they kill themselves. Exposure to suicidal behaviors of others, as I said before, family members, peers, media figures. When there's a well-publicized suicide, you'll find that the statistics go up a little bit in time. So it's important now to know that suicide is not a normal response to dealing with your problems. Most of us work to sort those problems out. And many people do have those risk factors I just spoke about and will never, ever commit suicide. They just won't. So this is research and it's statistics, but it's really important to hear that this nothing I talk about is a foregone conclusion. So this is something else that actually, when I began to understand this, really was of interest to me. I used to think that women who come to therapy much more often, who are probably much more likely to complain about being depressed, being sleepy, being tired, being anxious, being unhappy, being angry at their spouse than is a man. And that women are more likely actually to try to commit suicide, but they are less likely to succeed. And in truth, suicide was the seventh leading cause of death for males and the 15th leading cause of death for females in 2007. Men are more likely to kill themselves than women. almost four times as many men as females actually succeed in killing themselves by suicide. Firearms, suffocation, and poison are by far the most commonly used methods of killing themselves, of killing yourself. And men and women differ in their method. And I bet you're going to know this, that I bet just intuitively you're going to figure this out, that men are almost twice as likely to kill themselves by gunshot than women are. They're more likely to kill themselves by suffocation. And I believe that includes hanging. And then women are three times more likely to kill themselves by poisoning. And that includes overdoses of medication. So, and we look at that. The statistics and the research point to men being more apt to be violent. And, of course, firearms and hanging yourself are a more violent death than are poisoning yourself. And I was trying to sort out why men would be more likely to kill themselves. And several things come to mind. So let me just say, this is Gail Moskowitz. You're listening to Mental Health Matters on WRIR 97.3 on your FM dial. And if you'd like to talk to me today about this topic, which is not a fun topic to talk about, although it's quite interesting, call me at 649-9737, 649-9737. So why are men more likely to kill themselves than women? Well, in a way, I said it before, because women are more likely to talk about the things that pain them than are men. Remember a couple of months ago when Vicki Van Cleave came and spoke about how men's brains and women's brains were just so different in how they processed emotion, and that men were one-third more likely to talk than women, that women talk like two-thirds more than men do. Like, men say a certain amount of words each day, and women say two-thirds more than that. Well, in doing that, women are more likely to talk about the things that are upsetting them, and they are more likely to make connections with other people that are meaningful in the way of having emotional depth to them. Women are more likely to ask for help. Women are more likely to talk about fear, sadness, a sense of loss, a sense of degradation than are men. So what we know is that talking about those things help ease our pain about those things. And men are more likely not to want to live with some of the things that happen to us as we age. One, they don't want to live with a downturn of physical prowess. Men are very attached to their physical prowess. And they don't want to live with a downturn in economic security. Men are very attached to their vocations and their sense of self vis-a-vis work. Not to say that women are not attached. They're not. I mean, certainly I wouldn't say that. But women have a more multifaceted attachment to things that define them than do men. Therefore, men are more likely to kill themselves if they have a downturn in their physical prowess or in their economic ability. Another thing that you'll see is that adolescent boys are more likely to kill themselves than are girls. Well, I think I've said this before on the show, and I'll say it again because it bears repeating. When I was a young woman, I always thought that men had it easier in the world. I always thought they got the best jobs. They were recruited more to do this and do that. They got to play sports. Men got, you know, men were more revered. They got to run the world. And women really were in a second-class position. Now, I grew up in the 50s and the 60s, and perhaps things have changed. I don't know. Sometimes I don't think they've changed very much. But it wasn't uncommon when I was growing up for people to say that women couldn't do this or women couldn't do that. My God, I think it was just around the time that I was born that a woman could have a credit card in her name if she was married. So I lived in a world where I looked around and thought, darn, I want to be a guy. Well, not really. I don't really want to be a guy in terms of gender because I'm very comfortable with my gender. But I wanted their power. And I guess I grew up sort of feeling a little annoyed with them. They seemed to be able to choose what they wanted and get it. Until I started doing the work that I do now. And I started doing that work during the AIDS crisis. I went from treating women who had severe eating disorders to transitioning to treating men who were HIV infected, and then recognizing the amount of sexual addiction that some of these men were dealing with. And then I began to treat a more heterosexual population with sexual addiction. And the next thing you know, I find that my caseload is mostly men and not mostly women anymore, which I think is very different than most people's experience. I went from thinking that men had what they wanted to, on some level, feeling a little sad for them and what we as women had permission to do, and they didn't. We did not grow up with nearly the amount of pressure to succeed and to feed the family and bring home the bacon that men had. We were not pushed to define ourselves by what we chose, as opposed to defining ourselves by a multitude of factors. And the most important thing that I began to see was that women had permission to ask for help when they needed it. Women had permission to talk to their friends about the little things that were gnawing in their head. A woman could turn around to her friend and say, you know, this is going on with my body, and it's kind of weird. Is it happening to you? And men did not have that permission. They were allowed to gloat. They were allowed to pretend they were the biggest and best, but they weren't allowed to be vulnerable. And this, I believe, really adds to what happens when a man really needs help and their inability then to ask for it. And then it puts them in a position of being more likely of killing themselves. Now, something else that is in the media all over the place these days, and that's at what rate do children and adolescents kill themselves? This is Gail Moskowitz. You're listening to Mental Health Matters. I'm talking about suicide today. Not a fun topic, but an important one. If you'd like to talk to me about this topic, the number is 649-9737. Please give us a ring. Or if you're too shy to do that, and I understand, feel free to send me an email at any time just by getting on to WRIR's website and then clicking onto my page from there. So if you go onto www.wrir.net and then get onto the radio site, get into my site by pressing on my program, you'll see my email address there. And you're certainly welcome to send me a question, thoughts, or problems you might be having in relation to this topic. So is suicide common among young people? What does it really look like? Well, it's surprising, actually. Suicide was in 2007, and that's the statistics that are in front of me, and I don't know what it looks like right now. But in 2007, suicide was the third leading cause of death for young people, 15 to 24. Third leading cause of death, which is understandable since they're not dying of old age. They're dying, unfortunately, in car accidents and things like that. So little ones, 10 to 14, you know, it's not a big number. Less than 1%, less than 1 per 100,000. And in adolescence, it grows. And I'll finish the statistics in a minute because I have a caller. Caller, this is Gail Moskowitz. You're on Mental Health Matters. What can I help you with today?
Well, hey, I actually last spring had 3 suicides, one from like a 27-year-old, one from a 80-year-old and one from a 47-year-old that I went through high school and college with and roomed with. And I was wondering if you could talk about how suicides seem to happen in clumps in different areas, because I've heard some smatterings of information about that before. And I was wondering if you could talk about how change of life can lead to suicide sometimes, like menopause, being elderly, or, you know, breaking up or marriage, you know.
No, there's no question about that, and I really thank you for your questions. And why don't you go ahead and hang up, and then I'll answer the questions on the air.
Alrighty, bye.
Suicides do happen in clumps, and I spoke about that just a few minutes ago, that when suicide happens and it gets publicized, or the people around you can see it, touch it, and feel it, it becomes more of a thought that it is a possibility. And statistically, the rates go up. It's kind of interesting and kind of sad. But we don't think about suicide as an option until we think about it. And if it's not in front of us, we might not grasp that as an option. Or we've thought about it and thought about it and thought about it, and watching somebody else do it or hearing about somebody else doing it gives us more permission. But certainly the statistics, there's an upsurge in suicide when one happens. Two, loss is a big reason people commit suicide. We just talked about that. The downturn in economic stability, the downturn in physical prowess, and yes, the upsurge in hormonal imbalance, and that does happen in menopause, and you will find a little upsurge in suicide among women in that age group, because it's a transition physically and hormonally that takes a while, and for some people it's chronic, and it can confuse you, just as the transition to adolescence or having a baby. They, you know, turn our hormones upside down. So yes, there is that. And the third question that you asked me is, I forget. The third question, let me see, you asked, I've forgotten what the question is. Send me an email and I'll answer it next week. You gave me three questions. I can't remember three in a row. I'm sorry. Anyway, I hope that the information I gave you was helpful, and I hope you appreciated that. And really do send me an email and I'll be happy to answer the third question. So adolescents ages 15 to 19, 7%, 7 per 100,000. Are likely to kill themselves. And here's my least favorite number. Almost 13 out of 100,000 20 to 24-year-olds kill themselves. It's a tough time of life. We're going to talk more about this topic. And next time we talk about suicide, we're going to talk about healing from it, getting help, prevention. And we're going to do that in a couple of weeks. Next week, I have Eileen McHugh Brown, who is the Director of Youth Services for the City of Colonial Heights, and she's going to come and talk about adolescence, one of my favorite topics. Thank you for listening to Mental Health Matters. This is Gail Moskowitz. Listen to me again next Thursday at 1 o'clock when we're going to talk with Eileen McHugh Brown about adolescence.
In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double, don't worry. Be happy, don't worry, be happy now.